Blog Talk Radio.
This is the news in brief from the United Nations. UN Secretary-General Antonio Guterres has welcomed the renewal of the Black Sea Grain Initiative, which had been due to expire on Saturday. More than 11.1 million tonnes of agricultural products, including 4.5 million tonnes of corn and 3.2 million tonnes of wheat, have been shipped as part of the agreement, involving Turkey, Ukraine, Russia and the UN, since it was signed on the 22nd of July. Speaking on Thursday, Mr. Guterres said that he was deeply moved and grateful that an agreement had been reached. The UN chief also expressed his deep commitment to remove the remaining obstacles to the unimpeded exports of Russian food and fertilizers, as these remain essential to avoid a food crisis next year. Israel must immediately lift the so-called closed military zone it has imposed on the house of prominent Palestinian human rights defender Issa Amro, UN-appointed independent human rights expert said on Thursday. Israeli occupation forces established the zone around Amro's house at the end of October, a day after he tried to file a police complaint over Israeli settler violence. Amro, who is an internationally respected human rights defender and a civil society leader, regularly receives death threats from settlers and Israeli forces, said the experts. His house in Hebron in the occupied West Bank also serves as a community center of the Palestinian civil society organization Youth Against Settlements. The experts said that the house closure raises serious concerns about freedom of association and assembly in the occupied Palestinian territory. They have called on Israel to stop attacks on Palestinian human rights organizations and human rights defenders. Sea surface temperatures and ocean heat in parts of the Southwest Pacific are increasing at more than three times the global average and harming vital ecosystems, according to a new report from the World Meteorological Organization, or WMO, which says that sea level rise poses an existential threat to low-lying islands and their people. The climate update shows how weather-related disasters are undermining socio-economic development and threatening health, food, and water security. It provides a snapshot of climate indicators, such as temperatures, sea level rise, ocean heat and acidification, and extreme weather, alongside risks and impacts. In 2021, the region reported 57 natural hazards, 93% of which were floods and storms. Overall, 14.3 million people were directly affected by these disasters, causing total economic damage of $5.7 billion. The report highlights big gaps in observing systems and early warning services in the region, which will be one of the priority target areas of a new UN Early Warnings for All initiative. Nikki Chadwick, UN News.
For radio as godless as our Constitution, tune in to Free Thought Radio.
We'll talk about novelist John Irving, about Christian supremacy, and about the Respect for Marriage Act.
Then speak with John Wathy, author of the new book, The Phantom God.
Subtitled, What Neuroscience Reveals About the Compulsion to Believe.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, comrades. What a great day it started out to be here. Yes, it's TGIF Day. TGIF. We'll be jumping right into Democracy Now! When we have the second hour pretty much clear. If you'd like to call in, feel free, 646-716-8652.
Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We're broadcasting from the UN Climate Summit in Sharm el-Sheikh, Egypt. Talks are expected to go into overtime on the last official day of the COP27 climate conference here in Sharm el-Sheikh as delegates seek a compromise on an agreement over the issue of loss and damage and how to slow down global emissions to combat the climate catastrophe. Activists condemned an early draft agreement which failed to call for the phase down of all fossil fuels. On Thursday, the European Union agreed to a new loss and damage fund to compensate poor nations for the impacts of the climate crisis, but key actors, including the United States, have thus far objected to such a fund. In an 11th-hour appeal to climate delegates, UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres called on Thursday for nations to overcome a breakdown in trust between rich and poor and stand together to prevent the worst effects of the climate crisis.
This is no time for finger pointing. The blame game is a recipe for mutually assured destruction. I'm here to appeal to all parties to rise to this moment and to the greatest challenge that humanity is facing.
We'll have more on the UN Climate Summit here in Sharm el-Sheikh, Egypt, later in the broadcast. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi says she will not seek a leadership role in the next Congress after two decades spent leading House Democrats. Pelosi spoke from the House floor Thursday after midterm election results showed Republicans have won a narrow majority in the House of Representatives.
I will not seek re-election to Democratic leadership in the next Congress. For me, the hour has come for a new generation to lead the Democratic caucus that I so deeply respect. And I'm grateful that so many are ready and willing to shoulder this awesome responsibility.
In California, Democratic Congressmember Katie Porter has been reelected to represent the 47th House District in Orange County after a narrow win. Porter is a former UC Irvine law professor known for her tough questioning of witnesses during hearings of the House Oversight and Natural Resource Committees. Questioning, for example, the heads of Wells Fargo and Bank of America, as well as J.P. Morgan Chase. In Colorado, the race between far-right Republican Congressmember Lauren Boebert and Democratic challenger Adam Frisch appears to be headed for a recount. After initial tally showed Boebert's lead at just over 500 votes out of 327,000 counted. Boebert is a far-right Trump supporter, an election denier, and infamously vowed to carry her Glock pistol on the Capitol grounds. Last year, Republican leader Kevin McCarthy refused to sanction Boebert after she used racist language to attack her Muslim colleagues. Ukraine's government says 10 million people have been left without electricity after dozens of Russian aerial attacks targeted Ukraine's civilian infrastructure. On Thursday, the first snow of the season fell on Kyiv and other parts of Ukraine. In Russia, U.S. political prisoner, women's basketball star Brittany Griner has been moved to a penal colony hundreds of miles southeast of Moscow. Earlier today, Russia's deputy foreign minister said he hopes to negotiate a prisoner swap with the U.S. that would include convicted arms trafficker Viktor Bout, known as the Merchant of Death. Meanwhile, jailed Russian opposition leader Alexei Navalny said Thursday he's been permanently transferred to a cramped solitary confinement cell in a notorious penal colony east of Moscow and will be largely cut off from the outside world. The Biden administration's petitioning a U.S. court to grant Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman sovereign immunity in a civil case seeking legal accountability for his involvement in the 2018 murder of journalist Jamal Khashoggi. The U.S. State Department argued bin Salman's new role as Saudi Arabia's prime minister means that he's, quote, the sitting head of government and accordingly immune. Biden vowed as a presidential candidate to make Saudi Arabia a pariah for the state-sponsored killing of Khashoggi, who is a Washington Post columnist. But since taking office, Biden has refused to condemn bin Salman for ordering Khashoggi's killing and dismemberment. In the Gaza Strip, at least 21 people were killed and others injured on Thursday after a fire tore through an apartment complex in the crowded Jabalia refugee camp. In response to a request from the Palestinian Authority, Israeli officials said they would lift Gaza's normal travel restrictions to allow survivors to seek medical treatment in Israel. The FIFA World Cup soccer tournament opens in Qatar Sunday as human rights advocates condemn serious labor and human rights abuses against migrant workers who built stadiums and other infrastructure in preparation for Qatar to host one of the most anticipated international sports tournaments. Rights groups report thousands of migrant workers from countries including India, Pakistan, Nepal, Bangladesh, and Sri Lanka have died in the dozen years since Qatar won the right to host this year's World Cup. Qatar has also deported migrant workers who've denounced wage theft. In New York City, part-time faculty members at the new school have gone on an indefinite strike to demand a fair union contract. Adjuncts say they haven't received a pay raise since 2018 and that administrators' offer of a 3.5% wage increase falls short of keeping pace with record inflation. Meanwhile, nearly 50,000 student workers at all 10 University of California campuses are on the fifth day of an open-ended strike. The workers are demanding child care subsidies, better health care for dependents, lower tuition for international scholars, and are asking for their compensation to be tied to housing costs. In more labor news, thousands of Starbucks workers at over 100 stores nationwide walked off the job yesterday over the company's refusal to bargain in good faith with newly unionized workers. Starbucks workers in New York joined the day of action dubbed the Red Cup Rebellion.
Starbucks claims to be a progressive company, but they drive us to the bone every single day. Our health care is unaffordable for many of us. We have serious health and safety issues in our store.
We are on strike because we are fighting for better scheduling, fair wages, and the failure to bargain from Starbucks. They have not decided to bargain with the unions, which is an illegal activity. They've been stalling. They've been doing their best to avoid us.
Hundreds of Twitter workers resigned Thursday after rejecting new owner Elon Musk's one-day ultimatum to go, quote, extremely hardcore or leave within 3 months, with 3 months severance pay. Twitter has closed its doors until Monday as it figures out which former workers it now needs to cut access for. And amidst rumors, Musk is worried about internal sabotage at the company. Musk reportedly met with some workers in hopes of convincing them to stay. The hashtag RIP Twitter began trending on Twitter. On Thursday night, a light projection on Twitter's San Francisco headquarters trolled Elon Musk with the words bankruptcy baby, apartheid profiteer, and space Karen, among other insults. Alabama prison officials called off the execution of Kenneth Eugene Smith Thursday after they struggled to establish an IV line for his lethal injection. Alabama canceled another execution in September for the same reason. This comes after an execution team in Arizona struggled Wednesday with the killing of a prisoner for the third time this year. 76-year-old Murray Hooper had always maintained his innocence after being convicted of murder and sentenced to death in 1983 without any DNA evidence, but was repeatedly denied DNA testing. After failing to insert an IV into Hooper's arm, his executioners used a vein near his groin. Hooper reportedly turned to witnesses and said, "Can you believe this?" And Staunton Lynn, the longtime peace and civil rights activist, lawyer, author, and people's historian, has died at the age of 92. In the early 1960s, Staunton Lynn taught alongside his friend Howard Zinn at Spelman College in Atlanta and served as director of the SNCC Freedom Schools of Mississippi. He was a leading early critic of the Vietnam War. The State Department stripped him of his passport after he traveled to North Vietnam in 1965. Staunton Lynn was a conscientious objector during the Korean War, later supported U.S. soldiers who refused to fight in Iraq. He appeared on Democracy Now! In 2006.
The logic of those precedents is that a soldier in Iraq, or like Lieutenant Aaron Watada, under orders to be deployed to Iraq, can say, I consider this to be a war crime. Even if my superiors tell me something different, I am obliged to use my own judgment, my own conscience, and so I say no.
And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman.
This is Free Thought Radio with co-hosts Stan Barker and Annie Laurie Gaylor. Irreverent views, news, music, and interviews.
Imagine there's no heaven.
Welcome to Free Thought Radio. I'm Annie Laurie Gaylor.
And I'm Dan Barker, and this is Rational Radio and Blasphemous Broadcasting, radio for non-believers. Annie Laurie and I are co-presidents of the Freedom From Religion Foundation. This is the November 17th, 2022 episode of Free Thought Radio. Grant Blaschka, with Audio for the Arts, is our engineer in the Stephen Uhl Friendly Atheist Studio in Free Thought Hall, which is the national office of the Freedom From Religion Foundation in Madison, Wisconsin.
Free Thought Radio is the weekly production of the Freedom From Religion Foundation, as regular listeners know, and we work to keep religion out of government and social policy. And we are a bunch of irreverent people banding together to do so. Our members are freethinkers, atheists, agnostics, skeptics. We don't care what you call yourself. We all disbelieve in the same gods and want to keep God out of government. We're almost 40,000. If you are a member, thank you. If you are not, we would love to send you information, no obligation, and we keep all your contact information confidential. You can click the Ask for Info link at our website at ffrf.org.
And FFRF members are free thinkers, non-religious, atheists, agnostics. And if there is no God, the good question is, why do so many people feel like there is? As I used to feel when I was a believer. In the second half of today's show, the computational biologist John C. Wathy, who's author of the book The Phantom God, will explain how mysticism and the illusion of a God's presence is a natural consequence of how our brains are wired.
And before that, we will hear a remix of the godless gospel song, I Don't Need Jesus. This week on FFRF's Ask an Atheist, FFRF attorney Chris Line and FFRF's Director of Governmental Affairs, Mark Dan, who's based in D.C., spoke with Matthew Sheffield. He's a national correspondent for the Young Turks, also known as TYT. Matthew is a former Mormon and former right-wing media marketing expert who's now a non-believer working for progressive causes.
And during that show, which airs on Facebook Live every Wednesday at 12 noon Central, Chris Line asked Matthew Sheffield if Christian nationalists had any influence on the recent election.
While the term Christian nationalism is useful, I actually prefer the term Christian supremacist, because that's what they want. They want to impose this sort of Confederate-style Christianity on the rest of people. And if you happen to be of a, you know, no faith or a non-Christian faith, or a Christian who doesn't believe in this type of Christianity, then they don't care. They want dictatorship. One of their advocates actually reacted to that, this guy named Nick Fuentes, who is a white nationalist. He literally said after the election that, look, this is why we need dictatorship. We're in a minority. So the smarter ones among them, they know this, and they are not going to stop. Basically, their goal is to try to divide elections up into small chunks so that they can use their fanatically motivated base to, you know, win these elections without majority support. They don't care about majorities.
So you can still catch that Ask an Atheist episode on FFRS YouTube channel. You can look for the Ask an Atheist playlist. And we should point out that if you can't catch the show live Wednesdays at noon Central, we replay it at 7 p.m. Central on Wednesdays. So maybe after dinner.
So either of those two ways, or you can watch it on YouTube. We also have a TV show that is broadcast on many TV stations around the country. It's called Free Thought Matters. And this week, our guest on Free Thought Matters is the famous novelist John Irving.
Yeah, that was really fun to get to interview him. During the show, I asked John Irving how he came to write his book, Cider House Rules, which deals with the issue of abortion.
Well, I thought it was a good time for an historical novel to remind readers what it was like when that procedure was unsafe and illegal. I thought it was essential to say, if you're missing, or you think you're missing, when abortion was illegal, look at everything that happens in this story, because it could only happen at a time when that procedure was illegal and unsafe, and so many young women were faced with the prospect of mandatory childbirth or an unsafe abortion. It was my way of saying, do you really think you want to bring this back? Well, they have.
And John Irving won the Freedom from Religion Foundation's coveted Emperor Has No Clothes Award, which includes a plaque, a brass plaque of the emperor of the legendary Hans Christian Andersen fairy tale. It is given to public figures who tell it like it is, like that small boy in the fairy tale who says the emperor has no clothes, who tell it like it is about religion. And in this case, we gave, and separation of church and state, and in this case, we offered the award to John Irving after a powerful op-ed piece was printed in the New York Times that he wrote, where he was emphasizing that we don't just have freedom of religion in the United States, we can't have freedom of religion without freedom from religion. And we immediately offered him the award, and the acceptance was supposed to be during the pandemic. At the convention, we had to cancel. The Canadian border wasn't really open last year when we had our convention last year in Boston. And so this year he was scheduled in San Antonio, and he gave a remote talk because of medical reasons. But it was a wonderful talk, and that transcript will soon be published in Free Thought Today. But we do encourage you to watch this interview. John Irving is just an extraordinary person.
And you can watch that episode of Free Thought Matters right now on FFRF's YouTube channel. Just look for the Free Thought Matters playlist. And if you happen to live in one of the 13 cities where Free Thought Matters is broadcast on local television, you can watch that show every Sunday morning. For stations and times, check our website, ffrf.org/freethoughtmatters, or you can look for that show under our news dropdown.
So there's a lot of news this week, and we issued a press release yesterday saying we're taking the good with the bad, that FFRF has asked our members to urge their U.S. senators to vote yes on the Respect for Marriage Act. And as you doubtless know by now, the Respect for Marriage Act cleared a major hurdle on Wednesday, November 16th, in the Senate. and a vote and expected passage is imminent. And this Respect for Marriage Act would provide federal protections to same-sex marriage, essentially overturning the Defense of Marriage Act. The House already passed it, and Wisconsin Senator Tammy Baldwin shepherded the bill very carefully. She was the first out lesbian to be elected to Congress, first to the House, then the Senate. But the way that she ended up persuading bipartisan support to happen was by accepting an amendment ensuring religious exemptions for churches, universities, and other nonprofit religious organizations. So they will not lose their tax exemption or other benefits if they refuse to recognize same-sex marriage. So this is too bad. And it also says they can't be forced to provide services for celebrations. And that was really a non-issue. You can't go into a church and demand that a particular congregation and pastor marry you, even if you're a heterosexual couple. But there was a big bugaboo about that.
But that was a sop to the religious right.
It was a sop to the religious right, but there are a lot of legal ramifications. And Kat Grant, who is FFRF's Equal Justice Works legal fellow, is going to be doing another statement or blog going into some of the problems with this compromise. So we want to warn you, it's too bad this had to happen. It shows the hate that religion has for LGBTQ, that people, that this had to, that they had to demand this exemption. And the other problem with it is that although it says you can't discriminate against somebody who's been previously married, this federal law doesn't prevent a state from adopting language saying they don't want to allow same-sex marriage. And then, you know, this would go up to the Supreme Court. We have the Obergefell decision that codifies marriage equality at the Supreme Court, which is very much endangered. So this is not the end of the debate. But the other significance is that the Mormon Church supported the legislation. So you know something was wrong with it. However, so did FFRF. We need this very important protection.
Sometimes the best way to make progress is with compromise for a while, anyway.
Yeah.
So in other news, the Freedom From Religion Foundation is applauding a major victory for the separation of state and church in Arkansas, where voters wisely rejected an attempt to insert religious privilege in the state constitution. On the Arkansas ballot was something called Issue 3, which was sponsored by Christian nationalist state senator who would have placed the entire text of the Religious Freedom Reformation Act into Restoration Act into the Arkansas Constitution, giving churches and religious business owners an exemption to any law they didn't like for religious reasons. So we urged our members in Arkansas to show up and vote against Issue 3, and they did. More than 90% of FFRF members are registered to vote. So this is part of a national trend, and the defeat of Issue 3 in Arkansas is a testimony to the growing power of freethinkers and their ability to influence laws and policies in their states.
And we have to point out that this Religious Freedom Restoration Act played a hand in the Respect for Marriage law, the bill that's before the Senate, where basically that's the religious exemption that's provided for in federal law. So in other news, do you have an actuality on this, Dan? Maybe
no.
We don't. So Oklahoma Governor Stitt made this absurd prayer. I think it's too bad we couldn't have played it. Let's see, we should have thought of that. He claimed every square inch of Oklahoma for Jesus after he won re-election. And he said, Father, we claim Oklahoma for you, every square inch. We claim it for you in the name of Jesus. Father, we can do nothing apart from you. We don't battle against flesh and blood, but against principalities and darkness. And Father, we just come against that. We just loose your will over our state right now in the name of Jesus. We just thank you, and we claim Oklahoma for you as the authority that I have as governor, and the spiritual authority and physical authority that you give me goes on and on. We thank you that your will was done on Tuesday. And he's talking about the election. And Father, that you will have your way with our state. Sounds like he's going to rape the state with our education system, with everything within the walls behind me. Father, we pray that you will root out correction and bring the right people into this building. So talk about inappropriate entanglement between religion and government and religion and politics. And so we wrote Governor Stitt a strong rebuke, a letter, and it was, I think, covered on the front page of the Oklahoma City newspaper, the main daily there. So they did cover this controversy. And we pointed out to Stitt, of course, that we are not a Christian nation, that there's no God in our Constitution, that Jesus has nothing to do with our nation, our government, that our we have a secular constitution investing sovereignty in we the people. Regular listeners know this, but we clearly had to tell Governor Stitt this again. And it was really insulting and exclusionary to non-religious and non-Christian citizens. When you look at Oklahoma, 18% of them are unaffiliated with religion and another 2% belong to non-Christian faiths. So when he claims every square inch of the state for Jesus, he's saying that non-Christians don't count, that they don't belong. Really, it's a scary kind of proclamation to make. It is a Christian nationalist proclamation, a Christian supremacist proclamation, to use Sheffield's words.
And the governorship is not a pulpit. It's not a church. It's a secular office and should only have a secular purpose.
And it's shocking that somebody could get to that level of executive authority in any state and make this kind of proclamation. It's disgusting, really. And you can imagine the fury of Christians, and rightly so, were Stitt to have claimed Oklahoma for Allah, you know, or for Satan, or for atheism. You know, he's the highest ranking elected official, and he owes all Christians, all non-Christians, and all non-religious citizens of Oklahoma an apology. Really, he ought to resign. He doesn't belong in public office.
Well, so we're going to take a break, and after the break, we're going to hear a song from the Godless Gospel Concert, which debuted at our convention in San Antonio. The song is called I Don't Need Jesus, and we'll explain the song in more detail after the break. But then after that, we're going to speak with the scientist John C. Wathy about how religious experiences are created not by the supernatural, but they're created by the brain. I'm Dan Barker with Annie Laurie Gaylor. We'll be right back with more Free Thought Radio.
Hi, I'm Steve Pinker. In my book, Enlightenment Now, I show that the world has become a better place as reason has been overcoming superstition and tribalism. But the values of the Enlightenment are under attack. That's why I'm a proud member of the Freedom From Religion Foundation, the nation's largest association of free thinkers working to keep state and church separate. Please join me in supporting the Freedom From Religion Foundation to ensure that our government is driven not by religion, but by reason.
As Mark Twain said, faith is believing what you know ain't so. This is Free Thought Radio.
This is Free Thought Radio. Welcome back. I'm Dan Barker.
We are going to hear a song from Godless Gospel, I Don't Need Jesus. It is a song written by Dan Barker, my co-host, and it debuted at the National Convention of the Freedom From Religion Foundation in San Antonio in November. And it is sung by the Godless Gospel Choir. And Roger Phibbe, you're going to hear Roger Phibbe, one of the singers, doing his mock preaching during the second half of the song. And it starts with Dan, and then wait and see what happens.
So many solutions for the meaning of life.
So
$45,000 alone in Christianity. What confusion and strife.
They spread like a cancer. They rise and they fall.
Yes, but I have an answer.
and it does away with them all.
Yeah. time. True human happiness.
As Roger Sibby and the Godless Gospel Singers singing, I Don't Need Jesus.
It was D'Angelo Morant was the main lead. Wasn't
one of the
she?
Main
you
singers
heard Mandisa
of that.
Thomas there. That was I Don't Need Jesus.
We're going to take a break, and after the break, we'll talk with the scientist John C. Wathy, author of the book The Phantom God.
I believe in an America where the separation of church and state is absolute, where no religious body seeks to impose its will, directly or indirectly, upon the general populace.
Let's restore respect for America's secular roots. Help the Freedom From Religion Foundation defend the wall of separation between state and church. Join us at ffrf.org. Freedom depends on freethinkers. Protect the First Amendment. It protects you. This is Free Thought Radio.
I'm Andy Laurie Gaylor.
And I'm Dan Barker. Welcome back. When I was a believer in God many years ago, I actually used to feel something powerful. I felt a presence in my mind, like somebody was comforting me or talking to me or something. Those feelings are long gone, but it was kind of weird. It was a very powerful thing. Today, we're going to talk about that. John C. Wathy, PhD, is a computational biologist. He researches evolutionary algorithms. He researches protein folding and the biology of nervous systems. He worked for BioSim Technologies to develop software for pharmaceutical industry. He then started his own business, Wathy Research, often funded by grants from the National Institutes of Health. He's been published in many journals, including Biophysical Journal, the Journal of Neuroscience Letters, and as well as the Huffington Post, Skeptic Magazine, and the Jonestown Report. He's the author of the book, The Illusion of God's Presence, The Biological Origins of Spiritual Longing, which we have a copy of in our library here at Freethought Hall.
John Wathy's newest book is called The Phantom God, What Neuroscience Reveals About the Compulsion to Believe. Welcome to Free Thought Radio. And I should say, John, you're talking from San Diego.
That is correct, and I'm really grateful to be here. Thank you so much.
Well, I had the pleasure of reading an advanced copy of your book, and it goes a long way toward explaining those feelings that I used to have and many people have. I don't think Annie Laurie ever had anything.
No, I never did.
No, some people don't. But,
well, I wasn't raised with religion, so.
So basically in your book, are you telling me that those feelings that I used to have and that a lot of people have are basically biological?
Yes, I'm arguing that these kinds of feelings are completely natural, have a completely natural explanation. And I confess I've had them myself, not only as a religious person, but long since leaving the faith. I've had sensed presence illusions of one kind or another at various times. Not very often, but it does happen. And the essence of the idea is that it's something that's sort of left over from human infancy, from a period of time when we're, as a newborn infant, we're born helpless and completely incapable of sustaining our own lives. What I'm arguing is that a newborn infant has an innate neural model of its mother, of the not a detailed image of a specific person, but a feeling that there exists a savior out there, another being who will respond to your cries and feed you, keep you warm, sustain you. And this innate circuitry is normally persistent into adulthood, but lies dormant. It does nothing, but for some reason it's still there. And under unusual circumstances in an adult, it can be triggered, and it spawns this illusion of a loving, savior, which in an adult is easily interpreted in religious terms.
Wow. I know that in our experience, dealing with some people who have approached death, one of your close friends, Annie Laurie, she was calling out for her mother at the last minute. It was almost like going back. Something
well, that's
in the
very common.
Yeah.
That when people are dying, they call out for their mother, even if they're in their 90s. Isn't that?
But is that memory? Or John, are you saying that's something, sort of an underlying innate thing in the brain?
I'm suggesting it's even deeper than that. Yes, it is. It is, I think, a very innate, deep thing. I can give you an analogy that might help to explain it. Sea turtles, when sea turtles hatch out, they first dig themselves out of the nest in the beach, and then they have an innate drive and longing to reach the ocean. It's absolutely essential that they reach the ocean. And they have an innate visual model of what the ocean looks like from a beach. It's a very crude, simple model. Basically, all it is the idea that the brightest area on the horizon, averaged over some fairly wide angle on the horizon, must be the ocean. And that's because, normally, white surf and shimmering waves reflect the light of the sky better than sand, no matter what time of day or night it is. So that works pretty well in a natural condition. Under the present conditions of beachfront homes with artificial lights, that crude, simple model of the ocean fails, and they can be attracted away from the ocean into the houses, and they cross streets and get run over by cars, and that's why sea turtles are an endangered species now.
Are they attracted to the concrete, like, you know, in the daytime, the highway would look like beach to them?
It's mainly the biggest problem for them is hatching out at night, which they normally do. Another thing I didn't mention is that they have a temperature sensation when the sand above them is hotter than the sand below. When they're digging themselves out, they'll stop digging and wait for the sand to cool down, because they want to come out at night. It's safer for them to come out at night. So they normally do come out at night. And then the artificial lights are the problem. But the interesting thing is that adult female sea turtles, when they come out years later, come back to their natal beaches to lay eggs, they, after laying their eggs, again, have this same problem of finding the ocean. Now, as adults, they have a magnetic sense. Sea turtles have a very good navigation system based on the Earth's magnetic field, so it should be no problem for them to orient to the ocean and go back to the ocean. And yet, adult female sea turtles are confused and disoriented by artificial lights almost as badly as the hatchlings are. And they will sometimes, you know, head for the lights and get killed also. So, apparently, in adult sea turtles, that their innate visual model of what the ocean looks like is still there. They almost never use it. And yet, even though they have another sense that they've developed through learning over many years, this magnetic sense, the innate visual model is still there, and it overwhelms their magnetic sense, and they sometimes get confused and go the wrong way. So I'm suggesting this is something like that. It's something that fundamental, and for whatever reason, it persists into adulthood and gives human adults this susceptibility, this vulnerability to this illusion of a loving presence in times of crisis.
So why don't we all have it? Why did I have it as an adult, but Annie Laurie never felt anything like that?
I would say, like anything, it varies from person to person. Just about any trait you think of varies somewhat from person to person, even fundamental, instinctive, innate things vary from person to person. And not every person has a moment of crisis that severe as to evoke this feeling of God's presence. If you're not raised with religion, that, you know, makes the whole idea of projecting a God into those feelings less likely to happen. So even if those feelings do crop up, you might just pass it off as a strange feeling and not even hardly notice it. So There are people who just never have it for some reason.
Yeah, well, I can't think of anything that fits the description of what we're talking about. Your book says that the illusion appears remarkably like one that has long been familiar to neurologists, the phantom limb of the amputee. So we've all heard about this where somebody unfortunately loses a limb and yet they still have pain or they still have itch that you can never get at.
Huh. Yes, yes. And this is the main focus of my new book. The first book, The Illusion of God's Presence, focused mostly on behavioral ideas and psychological ideas. The kind of analogy I was just making to the sea turtle is one example of that. But the new book focuses specifically on the human brain and what we can learn from studying the human brain about this illusion. And I argue that it's the feeling of another person's presence it's a feeling of embodiment. And the illusion of a presence when there's not one there is an illusion of embodiment. The part of the brain that handles this, you know, we all deal with other people all the time, is in work, in school, at home with family. We're surrounded by people. We know about how far away they are, even if they're standing behind us and we can't see them. We sort of have a feeling of their presence and an awareness of not to step back suddenly and step on their toes. It's a spatial thing as much as anything. And there's a part of the brain that does this called the temporoparietal junction, or TPJ. And it's the same part of the brain that handles the computation and sensation of your own body. So you're always sensing warmth and the feeling of touch on your skin, the orientation of your limbs, whether you're moving or not. All of that is handled by the same part of the brain. The part of the brain that interprets your own body is used to interpret the bodies of other people around you. And that's why I'm arguing that this feeling of the phantom limb, which is so compelling, that people who have it will sometimes try to reach out and answer a phone with their phantom. It's so compelling because the brain always expects your body to be there. It's always there. Sometimes people are not around you, but your own body is always there. And the brain expects it so much that when part of your body is removed, it fills in the missing information for you and projects a phantom limb where there is none.
I remember reading Ramachandran's book about that about 20 years ago, and there's been a lot more progress in that field. We have to take a break here, John. We're talking with John C. Wathy. He's the author of the new book, The Phantom God. And when we come back, I want to ask you how this intriguing hypothesis of yours might be tested. So stay tuned. I'm Dan Barker with Annie Laurie Gaylor. We'll be back with more Free Thought Radio.
I'm Julia Sweeney, and I'm an atheist and former Catholic. I even wrote a play about it called Letting Go of God. Right now, Catholic bishops are using their considerable influence to deny women contraceptive rights. Please join the Freedom From Religion Foundation and help keep church and state separate. You can call 1-800-335-4021, that's 1-800-335-4021, or visit ffrf.org to stand up for true religious freedom.
Speaking freely, thinking freely. This is Free Thought Radio.
I'm Annie Laurie Gaylor.
And I'm Dan Barker, and we're continuing our conversation with John C. Wathy, author of the new book, The Phantom God, What Neuroscience Reveals About the Compulsion to Believe. So, John, we're talking about this feeling of God's presence, but the subtitle of your book mentions the word believe. There are people who believe who never feel anything, and is there a different explanation for the origin of believing than there is for the explanation of feeling the presence of a God?
You know, that's an interesting question. I would say there is a dichotomy that's very dramatic in the way people describe their religiousness. There seem to be two basic paths to religiousness. One that where a person will say they've always had this feeling of God's existence for as far back as they can remember, and they can't even remember when they started believing in God. Now, as you might imagine, these tend to be people who were indoctrinated with religion since early childhood. So that was something their parents always taught them. They always felt God was there. And I would argue that they, you know, their experience of God's presence is something for them that has been sustained in an almost continuous way in this infantile-like state or childlike state, so that there's no sudden break, no sudden conversion. And you could contrast that with people who do have sudden conversion, who either weren't religious at all or dropped it after childhood or whatever, and then at some point in their adult life, some terrible crisis happens. They're helpless, and suddenly they feel God's presence and pray and reach out and feel saved and are converted. So there seem to be these two distinct patterns of religiousness.
So you often hear about or see even movies about people who they go into a revival tent or a soul-winning moment, and there's all these people chanting and laying hands on them and praying, and then suddenly they convert. Are you suggesting that the feeling that they have at that moment is just a flashback to being a small infant, mm-hmm. you know, where they needed dependency on something, and so then they attribute that to a God?
Yes, I think it very often is. I think, you know, when the tent revival image that you just conjured up reminded me of Pentecostal services where believers, you know, writhe around on the floor speaking ostensibly a foreign language, which, you know, is a lot like babbling before they've acquired speech, before they've acquired language.
Before they can walk.
Yeah.
Oh, yes, before they can even walk, exactly.
Interesting.
There are many infantile aspects of religiousness.
Yeah, that's right.
Well, there's also the group aspect, too, because we're social creatures. And at the very end of your book, you say that a group of chanting humans becomes like a huge flock of starlings, as if they had a single mind. And isn't that also a part of it? You get into this group where you're singing or chanting together, and suddenly this evokes that latent feeling?
Yes, absolutely. In fact, I try to draw and I emphasize two aspects of religiousness, and especially what I call the two-faced God. Why do believers tell you their God will damn you to hell and in the same breath say that he loves you unconditionally?
That's a good question.
They seem to be blind to this contradiction. And yet, to me, that says that those ideas, those concepts of God don't come from careful reasoning, but instead from powerful intuitions, you know, that are operated on almost unconscious level.
You mean like a small child that is, you know, so dependent on the parent?
Yes.
Who loves that parent and feels like they're supposed to love them unconditionally, but then they're afraid of
being
abandoned or afraid of being disciplined or doing
something
wrong. Or
sometimes the parent is angry and abusive even, you know. Yeah.
Yes, right, exactly. And a person's conceptions of God will often be shaped by that.
So I think this is a fascinating hypothesis you make, and it seems like you build the case pretty strongly. And in your book, you ask, or I would ask after reading your book, how would you test this hypothesis scientifically?
But I would say it can be tested at least two distinct levels, at a behavioral or a psychological level, and it can be tested at a neurobiological level. In the first book, I emphasized the former, and in the new book, The Phantom God, I've emphasized the neurological tests. Those are a little hard to explain in just a few sentences, but there are, for example, certain drugs that are have very specific activity at certain synapses in the brain, and so I can predict that certain drugs will have certain effects on the tendency to have this kind of illusion. I discussed that in my last chapter. A more easier one to grasp is that in some of these feelings of God's presence, they're very spatially specific. A person will say, I felt God 5 feet away from me. I didn't look up. I kept my head in my hands, but I knew he was there. And in those kinds of illusions where the person reports God being at a specific place, sometimes we'll say on the left or the right side. So I would predict if you go through a long list of those, you would find more examples of God being present on the left side than on the right. Now, why I say that has to do with the fact that the right hemisphere of the brain, which perceives the left half of space, matures earlier and is more dominant in the newborn infant than the left hemisphere. So things like that make specific predictions. And I have a whole chapter on that, but it's probably too much to go into beyond what I've just said.
Okay, maybe that explains me, because I did actually feel, and my mom says that I was born left-handed, and I have to believe her because I feel like I'm right-handed now, but I felt a presence 2 or 3 feet up above the right side of the brain. You know what I mean? Like it was a parental thing.
Uh-huh.
So it might be reversed in people who are left-handed. Is that possible?
Yeah. No, that I don't know, but it's an interesting thought.
Well, I think it is reversed for southpaws.
Yeah. Or so, maybe I was just crazy. Who knows?
I don't think so, Dan. Yeah.
So John, we have a couple minutes left here. There are believers who will accept the science. They will accept the neurology of the brain, but they will say this is not creating illusion of God. It's a receptor. This brain is built to receive God's presence. Briefly, how would you respond to that?
What I would say is that's not something I can disprove. It's not something anyone can disprove. It's untestable. And because it's untestable, it's scientifically a dead end. And if you don't care about scientific reasoning, and if you're not a scientist, you can live with that. But for someone who is a scientist and who tries to constrain your way of thinking and your models of reality to things that can be empirically tested, then you have no way of distinguishing an idea like that from any other untestable idea. They're all equally probable or improbable. So I opt for the empirically testable ideas.
Well, thank you, John Wathy. John C. Wathy is the author of the new book, The Phantom God, What Neuroscience Reveals About the Compulsion to Believe. Thank you for being with us today, John.
Thank you so much for the invitation. It's been my pleasure.
And that's our show for today. Free Thought Radio is recorded in the Stephen Ohl Friendly Atheist Studio in Madison, Wisconsin. Greetings to listeners in Philadelphia, to WOOM, to Bryn Mawr, to WZML in Madison, Wisconsin, to WIDE and WMUU, in Janesville, Wisconsin, to WADR, in Bryan, Texas, KEOS, San Marcos, Texas, KZSM, Columbia, Missouri, KOPN, Eugene, Oregon, KEPW, Bellows Falls, Vermont, and New Hampshire, WOOL, Black Sheep Radio, Kingston, Rhode Island, WRIU, and then in Ithaca, New York, WRFI. And, of course, we have many thousands of podcast listeners. Give us a thumbs up on your podcast provider and tell your friends and family to visit Free Thought Radio at ffrf.org/radio.
You can also find out about the new podcast, We Dissent, featuring female attorneys working for secular organizations and representing FFRF included. Ask for more information about the Freedom From Religion Foundation at our website, ffrf.org, or join us. There's a link right there. Join. and you will support not only our radio show, but all of our very important state church activism and litigation, and become part of the largest Free Thought Association in North America. Tune in next week for more rational radio and blasphemous broadcasting.
Free Thought Radio is a production of the Freedom From Religion Foundation, FFRF.org. Irreverent views, news, music, and interviews brought to you by Annie Laurie Gaylor and Dan Barker.
I hope someday.
How much more to increase the price of oil next Wednesday?
Ready, VTA?
Yeah. Iran and
okay, he came in the building about 5 minutes ago.
Well, VTA.
Tell Snowden when it comes to 9, 8, 7,
they just
6, 10%. 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
VTA.
This has been the most divisive meeting the oil states have ever had. The 13 nations of OPEC have still not been able to decide by how much to increase the price of oil. Saudi Arabia...
How much time we got?
Yesterday, for further consultations with his government, he returned to the Vienna... This is Ed Fletcher in Vienna.
Hey, 2Q Howard. I don't have to tell you things are bad. Everybody knows things are bad. It's a depression. Everybody's out of work or scared of losing their job. The dollar buys a nickel's worth. Banks are going bust. Shopkeepers keep a gun under the counter. Punks are running wild in the street, and there's nobody anywhere who seems to know what to do, and there's no end to it. We know the air is unfit to breathe, and our food is unfit to eat. We sit watching our TVs while some local newscaster tells us that today we had 15 homicides and 63 violent crimes, as if that's the way it's supposed to be. We know things are bad, worse than bad. They're crazy. It's like everything everywhere is going crazy, so we don't go out anymore. We sit in the house, and slowly the world we're living in is getting smaller, and all we say is, please, at least leave us alone in our living rooms. Let me have my toaster and my TV and my steel-belted radios, and I won't say anything. Just leave us alone. Well, I'm not going to leave you alone. I want you to get mad. I don't want you to protest. I don't want you to ride. I don't want you to write to your congressman because I wouldn't know what to tell you to write. I don't know what to do about the depression and the inflation and the Russians and the crime in the street. All I know is that first, you've got to get mad. You've got to say, I'm a human being. God damn it. My life has value.
Lay your hands on the radio. Lay your hands on the radio there in the home.
It's that psychedelic time of the year. Do you know where your brain cells are?
Log Talk Radio.
You know, there's an enormous industry in this nation that is churning out day after day at the cost of billions of dollars the sensation, entirely erroneous, in the body politic that everything is okay and everything's going to keep on being just the way it is now on into the indefinite future. But of course,
Radio Free Canada
have not purchased that bill of goods.
Remember, all I'm offering is the truth.
You can handle the truth!
Welcome to Radio Free Canada.
Kansas.
I'm your host, Mike Dell, broadcasting from North Jefferson County, Kansas.
This is Fred Whitehead speaking for a series of programs on the hidden heritage of Kansas for Radio Free Kansas. Our topic today is the industrial workers of the world, or sometimes known as the IWW, or popularly known as the Wobblies. A term that is the Wobblies being to this day still obscure in its origin. A bit of background on what led to the formation of the IWW in 1905. First of all, there had been the experience of Eugene V. Debs, who had come out of Indiana, out of Terre Haute, Indiana, where his house still exists as a kind of memorial to Debs and the American Socialist Movement. Debs had been a railroad fireman and also was involved with other railroad unions, where he rose to a position of leadership. In his bitter experience with the Pullman strike in 1893-1894, Pullman being a company town in extreme northeast Illinois, Chicago area, that was literally a company town owned by the Pullman Company, which made sleeping cars for the railroads. The strike was defeated. Debs went to jail, and he emerged from jail convinced that trade unionism as such, of the old type, of the craft union type, could not be sufficient. Much of American labor, as it was organized at the time, was in the American Federation of Labor under the leadership of Samuel Gompers. Gompers, early in life, was a socialist, but he soon discarded that ideology. And the American Federation of Labor was organized according to craft unions. For example, in the railroads, there were the Brotherhood of Locomotive Engineers, the firemen, the trainmen, and so on, these were all separate according to the type of work that they did, running the trains, so forth. Debs moved toward socialism in the late 1890s and was involved in the founding of the Socialist Party in Indianapolis, Indiana in 1901. Also in the background after the defeat at Pullman was Debs's attempt to form an industrial union for everyone who worked for the railroads, and this was called the American Railwaymen's Union. However, it was not able to supplant the craft union approach. Another labor organization that was of great importance in the early 1900s, in the first decade of the last century, was the Western Federation of Miners, which came to be led by William C. Haywood. The WFM had fought a series of outright wars in the coal field, in the fields, hard rock mining, primarily in places like Utah. And the autobiography of Big Bill Haywood, as he was called, is a vivid documentation of these wars. Another figure was Daniel De Leon, who had founded the Socialist Labor Party. De Leon was a professor, actually, at Columbia University in New York, but also a Marxist. And he cleaved to the idea of classic concepts of class struggle advocated by Marx and his followers. The contribution that De Leon made, in part, was ideological. That is to say, he forwarded these notions into the early 20th century. One problem with De Leon was that he was very sectarian and narrow-minded and combative in spirit with those who were, in a way, his competitors for the allegiance of the working class. And finally, there was the legendary organizer Mother Jones, Mary Harris Jones, who had been active for many years already with the coal miners all over the country. The story is told of Mother Jones that she once visited a prison and she asked a man why he was there, and he replied, "For stealing a loaf of bread." And she responded, "If you had stolen a railroad, you would be a United States Senator." At any rate, by early 1905, various militants of the labor movement had concluded that a new type of organization for labor was needed. And so, on June 29, 1905, in Chicago, 203 organizers from 43 different organizations convened under the leadership of Big Bill Haywood. Haywood convened the convention with the following words: "Fellow workers, in calling this convention to order, I do so with the sense of responsibility that rests upon me and rests upon every delegate that is here assembled. This is the Continental Congress of the Working Class. We are here to confederate the workers of this country into a working class movement that shall have for its purpose the emancipation of the working class from the slave bondage of capitalism. There is no organization, or there seems to be no labor organization, that has for its purpose the same object as that for which you are called together today. The aims and objects of this organization should be to put the working class in possession of the economic power, the means of life, in control of the machinery of production and distribution without regard to capitalist masters. The American Federation of Labor, which presumes to be the labor movement of this country, is not a working class movement. It does not represent the working class. There are organizations that are affiliated, but loosely affiliated with the AFL, which in their constitution and bylaws prohibit the initiation of or conferring the obligation on a colored man. That prohibits conferring of the obligation on foreigners. What we want to establish at this time is a labor organization that will open wide its doors to every man that earns his livelihood either by his brain or his muscle. There is a great work to be accomplished at this convention, and every one of you must recognize the responsibility that rests upon you. In the proceedings of the convention, which are 600 pages long, we read parts of Eugene V. Debs' speech at this founding convention. In taking a survey of the industrial field of today, we are at once impressed with the total inadequacy of working class organization, with the lack of solidarity, with the widespread demoralization we see, and we are bound to conclude that the old form of pure and simple unionism has long since outgrown its usefulness, that it is now not only in the way of progress, but that it has become positively reactionary, a thing that is but an auxiliary of the capitalist class. They charge us with being assembled here for the purpose of disrupting the union movement. It is already disrupted, and if it were not disrupted, we would not behold the spectacle here in the very city of a white policeman guarding a black scab, of a black policeman guarding a white scab, while the trade unions stand by with their hands in their pockets, wondering what is the matter with union labor in America. We are here today for the purpose of uniting the working class, for the purpose of eliminating that form of unionism which is responsible for the conditions as they exist today. Debs concluded, "We must dispel the petty prejudices that are born of the differences of the past, and I am of those who believe that if we get together in the true working class spirit, most of these differences will disappear. And if those of us who have differed in the past are willing to accord to each other that degree of conciliation that we ourselves feel that we are entitled to, that we will forget these differences, we'll approach all of the problems that confront us with our intelligence combined, acting together in concert, all animated by the same high resolve to form that great union so necessary to the working class, without which their condition remains as it is, and with which, when made practical and vitalized and renewed, the working class is permeated with the conquering spirit of the class struggle. And as if by magic, the entire movement is vitalized, and side by side, and shoulder to shoulder, in a class-conscious phalanx, we move forward to certain and complete victory." Another speaker at the convention was Lucy Parsons, who was the widow of Albert Parsons, one of the Haymarket martyrs, whom we will discuss in another talk. Lucy Parsons survived for many years and was well known on the streets of Chicago for selling for $1 the speeches of the martyrs of Haymarket. Similarly to Debs, Lucy spoke as follows: "Let us sink such differences as nationality, religion, politics, and set our eyes eternally and forever toward the rising star of the Industrial Republic of Labor, remembering that we have left the old behind and have set our faces toward the future. There is no power on earth that can stop men and women who are determined to be free at all hazards. There is no power on earth so great as the power of intellect. It moves the world, and it moves the earth. I hope even now to live to see the day when the first dawn of the new era will have arisen, when capitalism will be a thing of the past, and the new industrial republic, the Commonwealth of Labor, shall be in operation." Another figure at the founding convention was the renegade Catholic priest Thomas J. Haggerty. We read on his Wikipedia entry that Haggerty had been a Marxist before his ordination in 1892. His formal association with the church ended when he was suspended by his archbishop for urging miners in Colorado to revolt during his tour of mining camps in 1903. However, he continued to consider himself a priest in good standing. Haggerty is credited with authoring the IWW preamble, assisting in writing the Industrial Union Manifesto, and drawing up the first chart of industrial organization, more commonly known as Father Haggerty's Wheel. Father Haggerty's Wheel is a famous graphic of American labor history. It's in the shape of a sort of pie chart with slices, as it were, for different parts of the labor movement. Among the major categories, it would be a department of manufacture, which would include metals and machineries, glass and pottery, leather, textiles, and so forth, a building department, a department of transportation, which would include railroads and marine, a department of agriculture and department of mining, which were one department which we'll discuss at greater length in another talk, and a department of foodstuffs, which included packing houses, a department of public service, parks and highways and so forth, and then a department of distribution. Samuel Gompers of the American Federation of Labor dismissed this graphic as Father Haggerty's Wheel of Fortune. We're not talking about Vanna White's Wheel of Fortune, but trying to recall and remember and restore to memory Thomas J. Haggerty's Wheel of Fortune for American labor. You can find these documents that I have selected from in this talk on the internet by doing a search, a Google search, for example, for Founding Convention of the IWW, or Father Haggerty's Wheel, or Lucy Parsons, Eugene Debs, Big Bill Haywood, and so forth. So there are a lot of resources available in cyberspace as well to begin recovering our hidden heritage. Again, this is Fred Whitehead for Radio Free Kansas. This is Fred Whitehead beginning a series of talks for Radio Free Kansas on the subject of Kansas history under the general heading, Our Hidden Heritage. One of the important books of 20th century American history was written by William Appleman Williams, who was a professor of history for many years at the University of Wisconsin and later in Oregon. One of his influential books is called The Contours of American History. In this series, which will follow no particular chronological order, though in the course of the series we hope to cover many significant topics in our history, we'd like to look at what shaped Kansas and shaped Kansas history in terms of the thought patterns, patterns of social organization, ideology, and culture that prevailed here. In his book, Williams talks about his point of departure being Weltanschauung, or worldview. Weltanschauung being, of course, a German term. More usable English term is simply worldview. In his book, Williams is concerned to trace the deep patterns of American history going back to the 18th century, and talks about things like mercantilism, even uses the word capitalism, and in some of his other books, Williams was much concerned to explore the idea that empire of some form had been extremely significant in American history. Similarly, this series will look at property rights. For example, the critical feature of 19th century Kansas history, or one of the critical features, was the dispossession of the Native Americans in Kansas Territory, then in the state of Kansas. Many of these tribes, some tribes like the Kansa, for whom the state is named, were native to this area, while others, such as the Delawares and the Wyandots and the Shawnees, were the so-called immigrant tribes who had been forced to come out here from places like Ohio for what they thought and were guaranteed by the United States government to be their permanent home. Another thing we'll be looking at is the formative free state period of the 1850s, where the Kansas-Nebraska Act provided that the question of slavery and, in fact, the definition of territorial and pending state government would be shaped by those who lived in the territory. And, of course, slavery being a critical issue, the extension of slavery was favored by people from Missouri, which was a slave state. And this prompted a ferocious armed combat that began in 1855-1856 with fighting, with armed struggle and conflict. The late novelist Truman Nelson came to Kansas, returned to Kansas in 1979, where I interviewed him for a film we subsequently made called John Brown in Kansas. And I remember Truman saying, "Kansas was big. It was bigger than Watergate." The momentum of the free state movement, which attracted some of the most brilliant and dedicated abolitionists and other free spirits, produced a momentum which extended for several decades after the admission of Kansas as a state on January 29, 1861. This momentum produced what has been called the laboratory of social experimentation, which we will explore in subsequent talks. One of the movements that was highly dramatic was the populist movement of the 1890s. And it is indicative of our present condition that I would wager to say most students, and indeed most people in the state of Kansas, have no idea what populism was and could not define the term. So one of the things we'll be dealing with is the issue of amnesia. And this is not a sort of passive process. I could almost coin a new phrase or a new word, amnesification. How is it that people could forget? The historian Lawrence Goodwin, in his book Democratic Promise, later abridged as the Populist Moment, states that the populist movement was the largest democratic mass movement in American history. So how is it that this could go into oblivion in public consciousness among our people? To put it more positively, as the novelist William Faulkner said, the past is not dead, it is not even the past. So recovering what happened in Kansas history is, as Meridelle LeSueur, another novelist and writer who grew up in Kansas, said, memory is a revolutionary act. So in this series, we will be endeavoring to take up a good many topics, many of which will probably be surprising to our listeners. What we intend is the restoration of what social scientists call agency. That is to say, how is it that we can develop a toolbox that will lead to definitive alteration in our circumstances and produce the means of transformational change? One of the influential historians of America was Carl Becker, native of Iowa, who earned his doctorate degree at Cornell University in New York. He taught history at the University of Kansas from 1908 to 1916. From Kansas, he went back to Cornell, where he is a member of the faculty until his death. I want to read a passage from Becker's essay entitled Kansas, Just the Beginning. Some years ago, in a New England college town, when I informed one of my New England friends that I was preparing to go to Kansas, he replied rather blankly, "Kansas? Oh." The amenities of casual intercourse demanded a reply, certainly, but from the point of view of my New England friend, I suppose, there was really nothing more to say. And in fact, standing there under the peaceful New England elms, Kansas did seem tolerably remote. Some months later, I rode out of Kansas City and entered for the first time what I had always pictured as the land of grasshoppers, of arid drought, and barren social experimentation. In the seat just ahead were two young women, girls rather, whom I afterwards saw at the university. As we left the dreary railroad yards behind and entered the half-open country along the Kansas River, one of the pair, breaking abruptly from the ceaseless chatter that had hitherto engrossed them both, began looking out of the car window. Her attention seemed fixed for perhaps a quarter of an hour upon something in the scenic outside. The fields of corn, or it may have been the sunflowers that lined the track. But at last, turning to her companion with the contented sigh of a returning exile, she said, "Dear old Kansas." The expression somehow recalled my New England friend. I wondered vaguely, as I was sure he would have done, why anyone should feel moved to say, "Dear old Kansas." I had supposed that Kansas, even more than Italy, was only a geographical expression, but not so. Not infrequently since then, I have heard the same expression, not always from emotional young girls. To understand why people say, "Dear old Kansas," is to understand that Kansas is no mere geographical expression, but a state of mind, a religion, and a philosophy in one. In the rest of the essay, Becker proceeds to consider sort of Kansas psychology, what it is that makes up the Kansas personality, if you like, or the Kansas mentality. To loosely paraphrase what he says, Kansas is filled with people of rather remarkable types. Carrie Nation, of course, famous for her violent attack on saloons, the great abolitionist John Brown, and so forth. What happened? Why are they here? Well, again, I paraphrase Becker very broadly, very loosely, But the suggestion is that they were all trying to go someplace else, but fell off the wagon and hit their heads, only they didn't die. They crawled to a water hole or were found by other travelers, but they were never the same. And after a while, they became as crazy as everybody else. So in this series, we will be engaged with these vagabonds, some from Kansas, some passing through, some who left never to return, but always shaped in some fashion by their dramatic experiences here. This is Fred Whitehead signing on again for Radio Free Kansas. Today I'm going to be giving a kind of reading of an interview that I did back in 1982 with a woman named Annie Sprang, who must have been in her early 80s at that time. This was a series of oral histories that I've done since that time called Radicals in the Heartland, which consists of taped oral history interviews with activists of all different stripes who spent some time in Kansas City in this part of the Midwest. Annie Sprang was a big, tall, kind of raw-boned woman, still pretty strong looking and sounding. She had gone to work in the 1920s in the packing houses in Kansas City, and the early part of the interview deals with her experiences there. But the part that I'm going to read today concerns an organization called the Workers' Alliance. And in the depths of the Great Depression of the 1930s, the socialists and communists finally decided to quit arguing and fighting with each other and to form a kind of united front and to work with each other to secure the basic needs of the people. And Annie talks about the conditions of the Depression in Kansas City, Kansas, and then some of the activities of the Workers' Alliance. We had people in Depression times that had nothing to eat. We hadn't a very good social welfare officer. He didn't care whether you starved or not. He wouldn't give you nothing to live on. No commodities or no nothing. People lost their homes and they lived in pig pens. They froze to death. They couldn't get no coal. You couldn't buy coal because you didn't have no money. The state or the county had to furnish it. You had to have something to burn or you froze to death. He just wouldn't allow no money for it. Finally, when we went down to McNamara, we went to him and he wasn't going to give us nothing. He couldn't be bothered, couldn't care less. We finally had a man and woman that said, let's go to Topeka, let's go to Governor Ratner. And that's Governor Payne Ratner, who was a Republican. I will never forget that man's name. Not if I live to be 100 will I forget. I said, what good will that do? He said, maybe nothing, but let's go. So we got together a committee of 10 people and went up there. We paid our own way. We bought our own gas and drove in two cars. We had a meeting. We went there that one particular morning. We left here, that's in Kansas City, Kansas, about 8 in the morning, and we got to Topeka about 9. We didn't get to see the governor until, I think, about 2 in the afternoon. He finally did give us a meeting. First, he said that he would talk to two of us, but we said, no, if you're going to talk to any of us, you'll talk to all of us. We're going to stay right here until you do. If it takes a month, we're going to be here. He said, now, wait a minute. You know I could have you removed. I said, all right, you'll have to feed us. That's all right. You can call your law. You call your police. We're not afraid of the police. We're not afraid of nobody. You just get to the point that you're not afraid of the devil himself. When you're starving and you see people starving, even your own, then you're going to do something about it, and it makes you mad. And you're going to be mad until you get something done. We went up there, and we appointed this man to be a spokesman. He turned around to me and he said, "Ann, will you be my co-spokesman?" I said, "John," and this was a man named John Waters, "John, you don't want me. I'm so mad and so bitter, I'm going to say something and I'm going to be sorry." He said, "That's why I want you." I said, "You're really asking for trouble, aren't you?" He said, "Well, we're all in this together, one or none, win, lose, or draw. We're in it together." I said, "Well, okay." Governor Ratner said he would talk to us. When this man told him the situation, he couldn't believe it. He said, "I send money there. I appropriate so many thousands of dollars there each month. Where is it going?" He just couldn't believe it. This man spoke up and he said, "There's 10 of us here. Do you mean to tell us you don't believe none of us? What kind of governor are you? Why don't you send somebody down there and find out what's going on? Come down there yourself and find out what's going on if you're so sure." He said, "Well, I understand you're a bunch of communists." I spoke up and I said, "If it's fighting for a livelihood for some older people, not for us, then yes, you're damn right. We're communists and proud of it, and we're going to be communists till we get help from somebody." He looked at me and he said, "You're really mad." He said to another man, "Go back in the office and bring the files. I want to show these people something." When he showed us the figures, we were amazed. We were staggered. What the state was sending to Wyandotte County, and people were starving to death, and the people weren't getting nothing. So Governor Ratner came right out and asked us who we thought was giving us the ripoff. Well, we didn't know. We blamed the county commissioners. He said, "Well, all right, we have to find out who is ripping you off, where it's going to. Somebody is getting it. Somebody is getting that money." Well, first of all, we thought it was the county commissioners. We had to go to the commissioners. Then we had to go to this Mr. McNamara, because he was over all of them, and what Mr. McNamara said went. He said, Ratner, "Get on to your county commissioners." So we went and we talked to the county commissioners and couldn't get heads nor tails from that. Then we finally went week after week after week after week, and finally I said to this man that was head spokesman, "John, you know what we're going to have to do?" He said, "No." I said, "Next Monday, when we go to the county commissioner's office, let's catch all three commissioners in the office. Let's take a committee of 25 people. When the last commissioners come into that office, somebody stand in front of the door and lock it. Nobody gets in, nobody gets out. Somebody from our committee is going to have to do all the phone answering. No matter who they want, they're not available." Somebody spoke up and said, "You know, we're all going to end up in jail." I said, "That's just fine. That's just what we want. At least we'll get two meals a day. They may not be fancy meals, but at least we'll get two meals a day." This was, she recalls, about 1936, 1937. Monday morning, we all went in together. I believe there was 30 people went. We had appointed a great big heavy set man. This is going to be funny. He weighed around 250 pounds, and we told him, "When the last commissioner comes in that office, you lock that door, put the keys in your pocket. Nobody comes in, nobody goes out, and nobody answers the phone. None of the commissioners answers the phone. We are going to answer the phone, and no matter what they want or who they want, we'll just tell them he's in conference and can't be disturbed." John looked at me and said, "And you're the telephone operator." I said, "Okay." The last commissioner came in and click went the door. He turned around and looked up and said, "Just don't worry. Don't get upset. Don't get all heated up. Just get you a chair and sit down." He looked at all of us. I was behind the desk and the phone rang. The commissioner reached and I said, "No, no. That's a no-no." I answered the phone and I said, "County Commissioner's office. May I speak to Mr. Brown?" I said, "I'm sorry. Mr. Brown is in a conference and he's not available." "When will he be available?" "I'm sorry, I don't know. It might be today, it might be tomorrow. I don't know." "Well, what do you mean it might be today, it might be tomorrow?" "Well, he's in conference, and I don't know how long the conference is going to last." "Okay, thank you." Everybody got the biggest kick out of it. They said, "Ann, you can be the politest person, and yet underneath you're just boiling with madness." So it went along, and this Mr. Brown that they asked for, he was a personal friend of mine, Dad's and two or three other people of the committee. He knew what we were after. He told those commissioners, "I'm going to tell you two commissioners something.
the day is coming when you're going to have to face those people. You're going to have to do something. I know what I'm talking about. Those people are desperate. We're all going to be into it, me and you and everybody else. Meanwhile, I found out that Mr. McNamara had a great big black nigger behind the door. If you came in, he would hit you over the head with a ball bat, real ball bat. I didn't say anything until the head county commissioner said, we can't do anything, you have to go and talk to Mr. McNamara. He's the head of it, he has the pocketbook, we can't give no clothing out, we can't do anything. I looked at one of the commissioners and I didn't like him at all. I said, I don't believe a damn word you're saying. He said, well, it's the truth. Brown said, Mrs. Northington, it's the gospel truth. We can't do anything because Mr. McNamara will not let us have it. I said, well, there's women sewing in the sewing room every day. Where's all that stuff going to? We want answers, and we're going to get them if we have to stay here a month. He said, well, I don't know. Then why aren't you finding out? We can't. He won't tell us anything. I said, well, he's going to talk to somebody, and he's going to be mighty glad to talk to somebody. The phone rang again. I answered the phone, and somebody asked to talk to one of the other commissioners. I said, I'm sorry. He's not available. He's in conference. Do you know when he'll be available? I'm sorry. I can't tell you. Will he be free at lunchtime? I'm sorry. I don't know, ma'am. They all looked at me kind of funny, like, why don't you know? Heavens, we stayed there. It was about 9 o'clock when we went in, and about noon, one of the commissioners said, let's break up for lunch. John looked at them and he said, what lunch? We didn't bring our lunch, and if we don't eat, nobody else eats. Nobody goes no place. Nobody leaves this room. He said, well, you know, there's a law against you people holding us as prisoners. We said, not as far as we're concerned. We're prisoners also. A lot of us haven't had anything for breakfast, and if we're hungry, we're going to see just how long you can stand it. I looked over to Brown. Brown just had the silliest smirk on his face. He never said a word. Finally, they said, well, can we send out for sandwiches? I said, sure, you can send out for sandwiches, but they won't come through that door. Nobody eats. One woman spoke up. I think she was in her 70s. She said, I haven't had a thing to eat for 2 days. I came here with these people. I'm going to stay here with the rest of them. The commissioners looked at one another, and Brown said, I told you, gentlemen, that. Now seeing is believing. They said, if we give you a letter to Mr. McNamara, will you release us? I said, no, part of us will go to McNamara and part of us will stay here, see what kind of answer we get from him. I turned around to Mr. Brown and I said, Mr. Brown, will you do us a favor? Anything I can. Will you get on that phone to Mr. McNamara and tell him that there's a workers' alliance coming up there to get rid of that damn black nigger he's got behind the door because we don't want to get our skulls cracked. He looked at me and he said, what are you talking about? I said, that's just what I mean. I know some people who went up there and they're in the hospital today. He looked at me and he said, where did you find that out? I said, what I know to myself, and I don't have to tell you people anything. But I'm going to tell you one thing. If we don't get some action from you people and from Mr. McNamara today, it's getting rather late. It was about 4 o'clock. We're going to Topeka, and we're going to bring a man that's going to find out where all this money is going to. We have black and white figures. We know how much money was sent in. When I looked at those commissioners, I knew they knew something about it. Mr. Brown said, we better write that letter and all three of us sign us. Now, who's going to go to McNamara? 5 people volunteered to go. They went and the rest stayed and held the commissioners prisoner until about 9 o'clock until we got what we wanted. We wanted clothing orders, coal orders, or fuel orders, and we wanted them that night. It was getting around 7 o'clock. They said they couldn't do it. They said, all right, the commissioners are locked in their office and we can lock you in yours. They're going to do something. And by golly, we got it. Those people were delivering coal at midnight. The last order that was delivered, they called the county commissioner's office and they called Mr. McNamara's office and said all deliveries were completed at 1 in the morning. That was the only way that they got out. Well, that is a section of the interview with Annie Sprang, taped in Overland Park, Kansas, in 1982. I remember in the course of the interview, she looked at those of us, I think there were 2 or 3 of us there, listening to her, And she said, the reason I'm telling you this is one of these days you're going to have to face problems like this and know what to do about it. And needless to say, the circumstances in the year 2010 in Kansas City, we're on the Missouri side, there are now proposals to close half the public schools on the basis of lack of funds and mass unemployment and all the rest of it. There may be some lessons in what Annie Northington Sprang was able to give us for posterity.